If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Welcome to another episode of And Security for All. We have another great guest here today. Super excited to have him here. We were actually, before we get on with the show, I would like to just do a big shout out to our Boston event yesterday. We had our annual Boston Cybersecurity Conference. Thanks to all our sponsors, speakers, and guests for being there yesterday. But so I can fix my technical difficulties, I'm going to get Zach Lewis on the show. He's the AVP IT CISO at the University of Health Science and Pharmacy of St. Louis. Hey, Zach, welcome to the show. And I got to turn off this other, something's going on over here and I can't get things going. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I got it off. Okay. Sorry about that. We were just talking about how we haven't had any technical difficulties, and I start the show right off the bat. Well, good seeing you, Zach. How's everything going in St. Louis?
You know, everything's good. The weather's finally turning. We're getting some of that cooler weather coming in just in time for Thanksgiving. So, well, I'll take it.
Yeah, it's crazy to think Thanksgiving, Christmas, it's all like, you know, right around the corner. I don't like when Thanksgiving is like the last week of November because everything just flies. And it must be exciting for you because you have three little kids. So
three kids this year. Yeah, it's a game changer. We're going to try to get people to come to us this year instead of me having to go there. It makes it a lot easier.
I just had that conversation with my son because they have four kids and I'm so used to doing the holidays, and they're like, times are changing now. We want to do the holidays. And as a mother, it's sad for me because I like doing them, but you got to go where the kids are. So yeah. Anyway, so that should be. So congratulations on your third child. Anyway, so let's back up a little bit again. My apologies for my tech issues, but let's talk about you a little bit before we dive into what we're going to talk about. Today we're going to talk about strengthening security through data classification and governance. But before we jump over there, let's talk about you and how you got over to your role over at the university and how you managed to get up so high. You're the AVP of IT and the CISO. And I know I said this on the last show, you're so young to have that title. And you said, I'm not that young, but I still think you are. So tell us tell us a little bit about your career path, because I'm sure there's so many people, as I know, in the St. Louis community, that people that live up to you, like look up to you, and you're a big role model here. So tell us a little bit about your career path and how you got to where you are.
Yeah, sure. One of my first roles during college was at a co-location hosting facility, downtown St. Louis, Datatel. I was there for just a short time, interning until I graduated, and then I went on to a tech startup. And I was there for a number of years working in that industry, and right out of college, it's a great place to be. Massages and oil changes and haircuts and bar and everything else you could imagine at a tech startup in the greater St. Louis area. It was pretty awesome. But after leaving there, went on to Energy with Arch Coal, and then I started getting into education. I was with the St. Louis College of Pharmacy for a number of years, left there, went to St. Charles Community College, and then came back to the St. Louis St. Louis College of Pharmacy, and now we've rebranded University of Health Sciences and Pharmacy. But I think in total, if you put it all together, I've been there about 9 years now, give or take, in a number of different roles, from client systems engineer to sysadmin, network admin, manager of the help desk, director of IT, and now I essentially wear both the CIO and the CISO hat.
Wow. I mean, that is a lot, wearing both of those hats. And, you know, kudos to you, because I certainly don't see people stay at their job as long as you've stayed over there. I know you've had lots of different titles, but what is the secret of your success for the longevity of staying in one place in a university where I'm sure, you know, this is a super competitive industry. I'm sure you're always getting scouted out for. That's not always easy. I don't think that's always the answer to just jump out of the pot and go into a new job and then you're right back, miserable again. I think we have a big problem in this industry of people not securing the right kind of talent, people needing more talent. So what is your advice to those other companies and your other peers that are just keeping employees as long as you've been there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I think what they're saying, the average time for the tenure for a CISO right now is about 18 to 24 months. Higher ed is not the place to go if you want high pay. That's just a known thing. But what I value at the university is that I get the flexibility to touch a lot of different things and wear a lot of different hats sometimes. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. I can tell you the CIO and the CISO don't have to fight for budget, though, here. I get to pretty much make that decision unilaterally. They give me the flexibility to travel around to conferences. I get to talk, I get to present. Like I said, play with different tech. I got a pretty solid boss who knows I like to stay engaged. I like to keep learning. So we put all these, goalposts in where I'm having to complete courses or get this certification or take this class or go here to do this or whatever. And as long as I have something to, strive for, go to, I stay engaged and stay pretty happy. So they give me at least that and a pretty good work-life balance in terms of flexibility. For my team as a whole, I tried to do similar things. If you need to work from home, you need to be hybrid. I got people working all over the country, and that seems to work for them. Give them, whatever they need minus, high pay, which is about the only thing I can't do. But if you want to go to school, if you need to send your kids to school, sometimes people come in and want to stay for a Christmas party or a department party, and I'll put them in a dorm room. It's little things like that. Just keeping people human, keeping them engaged, giving them something to really learn and push for. I think is a real big help in the industry. You hear stuff about how there's like 1.2 million jobs open on the market, and they just can't fill them. And if you actually look into some of that data, you'll seem to find that that's what these bodies that make those claims seem to think is needed. And that's one thing, but what the organizations need is completely different. So it's a weird market right now where there's probably not as many jobs as people think there are. So if you can get good people, keep them, and I don't think people are bouncing around as much as they used to anyway.
Yeah, I agree. I have so many people that come on the show and they talk about all these jobs, and then I'll have, listeners chime in and say, well, where are these jobs? I'm looking for these jobs. So I think there is a lot of false information out there. I think there's a need because we are in the industry we're in, and we, staying ahead of breaches, and all of it is hard work, which kind of takes us into what we're going to talk about today, strengthening security through data classification and governance. Can you break that down for us a little bit and, give us a little synopsis of what you would like to cover with that?
Yeah. You hear a lot about different breaches that have happened, across various organizations, and we'll kind of dive into stuff we've experienced at the university, but a lot of that comes from data exfiltration happens in these attacks, and you need to know what's in your data, where is your data, who has access to it, kind of how are you maintaining that, and then putting structure around it, making sure the proper people are accessing it, so if anything does happen, what's in it. How you're fitting into regulation, how you have to report, and you can say, definitively one way or the other whether there was a material incident or not. So that's kind of what we'll talk about a little bit. There's going to be a handful of different pieces in there, but I think it's good information for people to have.
Well, why is data classification? Well, first off, what is it and why is it important to different organizations?
Yeah. So for us, we have four tiers of classification. We have restricted use, we have confidential, we have internal, we have public. Well, those are pretty standard across the public sector and in some of the private sector as well. But with that, our restricted use policy dictates things like PII, social security numbers, credit card numbers, things you don't really want to leak out. Those would be bad. So we very much want to limit what's in that. Now, we also fall under some regulation as well called FERPA. And that's pretty specific to higher education. But within that, it says we have to protect things like student grades, student course loads and classes and accommodations, things around the education sphere. So we want to keep that secure. And by that, I mean, we don't want to be sharing files to outside entities that might have a load of student grades and social security numbers and addresses in it. We could get into confidential, which might be board minutes or decisions that have been made internally about the structure of the company, financial statements, things of that nature. So you set these policies, these classification policies, rankings sort of where your data would fall into. And then once those are kind of established, you say, what do I want to happen to this data? Do I want it to go externally? Do I want these departments being able to share it? Do I need these people to access it? So that way you can start trying to contain and protect those crown jewels.
So are there different organizations like universities, financial institutions, healthcare institutions? I assume all of them are dealing with different data classifications, but is every organization having to deal with these issues?
I would say if they're not, they really should be. But yes, absolutely. Every organization should be having some sort of data classification journey happening, or at least be considering it, have a policy in place around what falls into different policies. But yeah, it's not just a specific industry problem. It's a organization-wide, worldwide, global.
Well, what are... Where would a company like break this down a little more for us? Like, what are some of these data classifications? Where would an organization start? And who's on the security team? What are those titles of those people that are implementing those data classifications? Is that you or who is it on your team that's doing that?
So that very large question there. I think at least for our organization, I think you might see this in similar ones too, is typically you have first you have a smaller group kind of making some of these decisions. And a lot of this came to our enterprise risk management committee. They tend to get a lot of these sorts of requests. So there's a makeup of, general counsel's there. I'm there, our COO's there, the CFO is there, head of marketing is there. And we have a lot of our large players, our chief academic officer, among others. And we kind of come together and talk about, our data and what is in it and how people need to access it. And from there, we kind of sculpted what our policies look like for those different classification levels. Now, once those were established and that policy was codified, we took it and, we disseminated it through the university to all the different departments. Hey, guys, if you have this type of data in, marketing or this type of data over here in financial aid, these are the protections and controls we need around it. Now, the Enterprise Risk Committee can't necessarily watch that all the time. So we've picked out what we'll call data owners and data custodians in all these departments. So these might be people who are responsible and own the data in their department. And then there are our team members, these custodians who, make sure it's getting classified and making sure it's being stored properly. And these two kind of work together and their department to make sure that their data follows the policy that's been set down by the Enterprise Risk Committee. So that's the manual process. That's always been the way of doing it. I mean, historically, at least for us and others that I've talked to, it's a manual process where you go in, you're trying to make sure that stuff is handled appropriately, sent out appropriately, and whatever. Now today, currently, there's a lot of new platforms out there that do it, the data platform, security management, DPSMs, handful of companies in that space that will go in now and actually plug into your environment. They can scan that environment and ingest your classification policy. And from there, they can auto-label your files based on your policy. So it takes off a lot of that manual effort work that people have had to do before. But now that, you know, AI or machine learning or whatever is going through and kind of handling it for you.
You know, I just had a guest, it may have been last week or the week before, a CISO from a very large enterprise, you know, global company. And we were just talking about all the admin stuff that he's bogged down with, how much of this admin stuff falls into this data classification and making sure that your compliance, you know, that you're up to speed with your compliances and your regulations. How much of that is taking your time? Do you feel like, you know, there's so much paperwork that you have to do that it's keeping you from your job?
The longer I've been in this role, the more I've strayed away from the, you know, any hands-on security type stuff I've gotten to do. And now it's a lot more of reading contracts. It's making sure that the policies we have in place are enforced. It's winning some hearts and minds of different departments. I feel like I meet with people. Most of my calendar is just filled with meetings. Some of those are self-imposed meetings that I've set up, and others are, you know, for the organization. But I try to go around and meet with these various departments and pitch, you know, whatever IT or security is doing in a given quarter and update them, let them know what they're going to see, answer questions, and it keep me in the department, essentially keep security in the department of top of mind. You know, what are your processes that you do? What's your critical work that you're doing? What are your critical systems? If this goes down, you know, how are you guys going to respond? How are you going to be able to function? And I need to know these processes and these procedures that are going on. So that way I can see, hey, well, you know, you're doing this manually. We have a way to, you know, make this automated for you, or we have a way to streamline this, or why are you not using this tool? Let's get you in there. You need training on that. And that way I can start to hear about the problems people have. And instead of, you know, people growing, you know, disgruntled from technology not working or from security prohibiting them from doing their job. And then they grumble about it and they get mad and, you know, they don't want to come to us. But that way, if I'm always out there and visible and reachable, they can let me know. And we can try to make things a little bit more seamless. So I do a lot of that sort of thing. I mean, the data governance piece has been taking some of my time lately. We've been on this journey of ours for about a year now. I fully anticipated when I started it to be probably about a 3-year journey to get in a really good place where everything was sort of classified and codified and functioning in an almost automated habit forming space. And like I said, we're only a year in, so we're getting ready to start tackling data retention next, which is with our classification policy, we also have a retention policy. How long do we keep things? And then you're supposed to purge things. And the university as a whole is fantastic at keeping things. We keep everything. We have every paper from the university was founded in 1864, and we found meeting minutes from board meetings in 1864. We literally have everything from forever. Some of that stuff you might want to keep forever, but there's definitely a limit to that. And there can be, you know, compliance reasons, there can be legal reasons, and just, you know, storage upkeep reasons why you wouldn't want to keep something forever. So we're really going through now and taking a look at, do you really need to keep these, you know, these meetings or these recordings or these notes from, you know, 15, 20 years ago? And especially if that data is sensitive in nature, do we necessarily need to keep, you know, 2000 student grades from 20 years ago? Probably not, but there have been instances in legal instances, I guess, not with us, but out in the world, where a company was supposed to have gotten rid of data after, you know, 7 years or something, and they didn't. And then when they were brought to court and subpoenaed, they actually had to provide that data, even though they should have been purged, and it actually cost them money in a lawsuit. So, you know, it's things you have to think about there, where if you have it, you still have to produce it. If you're ever asked for it from a subpoena or from a court system. So, you know, it's just good housekeeping, cleaning that stuff up. You don't ever want to get into a situation like that, obviously, but.
Wow. That's crazy that you have that much data from all the way back from the beginning. So tell us, let's talk about like the other side of things, the companies that maybe are not using any sort of data classification. I'm sure there's tons of companies out there that, you know, you're just trying to make money and just trying to keep people employed and, you know, doing your day-to-day business. What are some of the downfalls and the risks that they face by not, you know, following certain guidelines and keeping things classified?
Yeah, I will actually start with an example from us about why we got on this journey in the first place. And I think that'll reflect pretty closely to why other organizations should. So a couple of years back, we actually had a pretty decent data scare, data breach scare, where we thought a ton of our data had been stolen and leaked out on the dark web. With that, the conversation piece became internally was, well, hey, if we think, you know, X amount of data has been taken and stolen, is that a material worry? Is that sensitive data? Is that compromising data? Is that something that's going to affect, you know, our students or our faculty or our staff or anything like that? And we could not necessarily determine that. We were able to see file names, but, you know, what's in that data? We didn't know. And not knowing was very uncomfortable. It's a difficult decision to make. So when I compare that to companies that have gone through, you know, ransomware incidents or data extraction and extortion incidents, it's like, okay, well, you guys have been ransomware, your data is encrypted, they've stolen a bunch of your files. What do they have? Do you even know? And let's say they're going to charge you, you know, $10 million is what the ransom payment is. Well, what are you paying for? Are you paying for just a bunch of how-to documents and public notices, or are you actually paying for that sensitive data that would harm the organization or your employees if it was leaked? So, you know, having a good classification policy and classifying your data appropriately will let you know that. You can see if that data has been accessed or extracted. You can, you know, based on file names, you might be able to determine, you know, more accurately, you can search your classifications. Well, what should that be labeled as? Okay, it was labeled as confidential. That might be important. You know, that I don't know if it's worth $10 million, but if you have, you know, 5 terabytes of files that have been stolen and the majority of them are confidential or restricted, that might be worth the conversation around, do I need this leaked out on the dark website or am I going to pay a threat actor? Obviously, that's a business decision, and I'm not going to say one way or the other what you should do, because that's something you have to determine for yourselves internally. But definitely a conversation piece that needs to happen.
So do you feel, I mean, first off, I would think when you, I mean, we as a company are kind of, you know, starting something where we're having someone look at all of our different processes, you know, to make sure that we're doing things securely. And I think we just did this like a year ago, but again, you know, but it's overwhelming, you know, it's inconvenient, you know, it's not fun to do when you're trying to do day-to-day business, and we're just a small company. So I can't imagine how overwhelming that is for you. Is it easy for companies to just procrastinate on that? And, you know, do you feel like most companies are waiting until something happens to them before they take it serious?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, thinking of data classification is top of mind, right? When you're talking with your leadership team or giving a presentation to the board, typically, hey, are you guys classifying your data? The conversation piece that happens, right? That's not usually the sexy side of security, but something that happens definitely after a breach. And I think you're going to see it as a conversation piece as we move more into this generative AI world as well. One of the things we've seen from Microsoft Copilot, for instance, is if you roll that out in your organization, people can query Copilot for, hey, where's all the salary information at? Hey, where's this HR information? And they're actually getting results back from improperly labeled or improperly shared or whatever files. So what's pretty much recommended at this point is actually go in and have good data classification, have good governance around your data and access there. So when you do roll out these agents, they're accessing only what, you know, the user should have access to, and not necessarily everything, because that can open its own can of worms. And we're not even talking about threat actors. This is just internal stuff now. And it's also, you know, a good practice for protecting against insider risks too. You know, you have a disgruntled employee, or you have, as we've seen with some of the larger security firms, they're having, you know, Chinese nationals try to come in and masquerade, threat actors from groups over there masquerade as employees and steal, you know, research data or proprietary information. So, you know, making sure those proper protections are in place can really save you some heartache down the road. But I think you asked me about are companies procrastinating on some of this. And I mean, I think so. I think prior to the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, again, this was a very manual process. And if you was something you'd never done before, coming in and looking at 4, 5, 10, 20 terabytes of data, classifying all that is that's a hefty job. Like that's wild to think about someone having to go in and do that, or even a team having to go in and do that. I remember during our data scare, our data breach scare, we talked about, you know, if a threat actor had taken 100 gigs of data, well, how are we going to know what's in it? Well, we're going to have to go through it. Well, what's that look like? Well, I mean, I'm going to need a team of people to go through these. You know, 100 gigs of data could be hundreds of thousands of files. And to open each one of those up and check to see what's in it, it's kind of mind-boggling. So we're seeing, like I mentioned before, we're seeing some tools come out on the market now that can do that from an automated, you know, AI, machine learning, contextual standpoint, where they can actually read some of those files and based on context and contents can label that for you in a much faster, much more accurate way than the manual process before. So there are ways to make that job easier for you if that's the journey your organization wants to go down.
So when you implemented this policy, like your new processes, or not your new processes, when you decided to look at your data classification and see what you were doing and getting it more in a better security posture, I guess, how did you deal with all the different sectors of the company that were the non-security, you know, departments? Were you just having your security teams just go in and just, are you looking at each part of the company to make sure that they're being compliant with all the information that they have?
Yeah. I mean, essentially that. So we had, you know, we have numerous departments in the organization and the university. And what we did was we first structured how we wanted data to be secure in our classification policy. So we built this out. This is kind of data that's important to us. This is pretty important. And then these others are kind of like, whatever, you know, we have our different policies for the data. And we disseminated that out to all the departments. And then a lot of emails followed around why we were doing this. What's this mean? Here's some examples. A big, you know, campaign sort of around that. So you get that out there. And then we start meeting with departments. And this is kind of where the record retention policy comes in. And we're meeting with financial aid. Oh, hey, what are the federal regulations around storing financial aid information and scholarship awards and, you know, money that we've gotten in federal aid? Okay, it's, you know, 7 years here, it's 5 years here, or whatever. All right, we're going to put that in the policy and make sure we've captured it. Now I'm going to go over here and I'm going to talk to the business office. Hey, what's the regulation or best practice used for storing, you know, invoices or sales receipts or, you know, student tuition payments or whatever? You know, so you got to go to every single department. You got to talk to the majority of the department, if not the whole thing, not just the tippy top. You got to talk to the people, you know, working in the weeds there, about, you know, what kind of data they're touching and what they're working on. So as we meet with each department, we're building out these record retention policies. We're talking to them about our classification policies around what kind of data is going to go in there. And you build these policies out, they get approved. We take these tools I've mentioned before that kind of do them automated wise, and it comes in and it goes in and it automatically labels everything that we have current. So all the old data is getting labeled based on these policies that we have now. With this record retention piece, we're also looking at right now, currently we're looking at email. So we don't have anything from an email standpoint that we purge email. So if you've been at the university for 15 years, you have 15 years worth of email, assuming we have the storage for that. So some people have hundreds of thousands of emails, and it's, well, do you need that? What's in that? I bet you've sent some stuff that's probably sensitive. If there was ever an incident and that was compromised, okay, well, what do we do about that? So we're going to start looking at, you know, how long we want to store email, let's say 3 years, and we're going to put retention on that. So from now till 3 years from now, you know, we'll keep that data. And then anytime older than 3 years, we're going to purge it. We'll make some exceptions for that with there's ways in Outlook where you can set things to store for 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, different folders and things like that. We'll set that up, but that's going to be a big education campaign for our campus. It's going to be a lot of hearts and minds have to be won, a lot of conversations, because that is a huge change the way people have operated. But it's something that the leadership team and the board is interested in from a standpoint of securing the university from things, stuff that our board members, for instance, do at their day jobs, at the companies they work at, that they would think like, hey, why aren't we doing it? It makes sense to do it. So I kind of have the backing from the top. I just have to go out and win the hearts and minds of everyone else and try to get all that instituted and set up and people trained on it, which is why these processes take such a long time.
And that is a lot. And that was kind of going into the next question I was going to ask you is not only how do you educate the other employees that are not on your security team, but how are you educating the employees and how are you motivating them to even follow your rules? Because some people probably really don't care. They're just, you know, unfortunately, what did they say? You know, 20% of employees make a company, and then, you know, maybe the stats aren't, maybe it's better than that. But for large organizations, you may have people that are just there to check in and check out and get their paycheck. So how are you managing those type of people to take security serious and what you're doing serious?
Sure. And you know, a lot of that comes down to you've always heard that there's not a technology fix for everything. You know, a lot of it is a people fix and a process fix. And I think we're actually at an interesting point in time where, yeah, it's still people based and you still need to, like I keep saying, win the hearts and minds of those people and talk to them. But we are seeing more technology fixes, too, that can kind of help with some of that. So I mentioned the tools that are classifying our data. Well, with that, we're putting rules in place. So when new files get created, and people are adding content to it, or they're putting, you know, grades in there, they're putting social security numbers in files or something. These tools are watching for that. And as those files get saved out into our, you know, our OneDrives, our SharePoints, our Teams environments of the world, you know, they're automatically getting classified right out of the gate. And because they're getting classified as, you know, restricted, confidential or whatever, we already have those controls built in on the back end about what can or can't happen to files that have that policy. So we've kind of taken it out of the people's hands, out of the end user's hands. So we don't necessarily have to rely on them. We are relying on the tool to do it. And you know, the tool can be wrong, and there are ways to request, you know, changes in classification or removal of classification. And I'm sure people will try to get around it at some point, but, you know, well and far above what we've ever done before. Now we have a pretty good automated system that's catching the vast majority of all this stuff, labeling it appropriately and putting the controls in place for what can happen. So then you think about the email piece. Well, we'll put in an automated control there that, you know, once an email hits 3 years of age or older, it's going to get archived out. It's going to get blown away unless it's properly tagged a different way or in a folder that keeps it for a longer period of time. That's where the learning piece comes in. So then I put the onus on the end user. Like, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to, but I'm going to purge all this data from your mailbox. So if there is something you want to keep and you really like it, you've got to move it. And that becomes the thing the end user has to do. So, carrot and a stick, I guess. I make things easier. I clean things up to make things run smoother, easier to find, give us some nice tools and some bells and whistles. But also at the same time, if you're not participating, you know, things are going to also happen automatically on the back end. We're going to take kind of the measures we need to take to get stuff done. We just kind of do it.
Well, I guess, again, this would go into some of the next question I was going to ask you is like data classification and governance. How does it tie into some of the emerging fields like AI and machine learning? Are these tools helping? Is it making your job? Are you finding the right tools to make your job easier, especially when it comes to monitoring?
AI is great. You know, I think if we had had a conversation about AI maybe 6 or 9 months ago, I would have been more skeptical. You hear a lot about AI. Yeah, it's cool. Everyone wants to talk about it. We've kind of been beating the horse on it a little too much, I think. But the more I've started to play with it and read about it and learn and use it, and it's a pretty impressive tool for a lot of different things. I know not everyone is completely on board yet, but our book I read recently said, you know, at this point we're using probably the worst AI we will ever use in our lives right now. It will probably likely only keep getting better and better. So if we're already amazed at what it can do now, I do look forward to seeing what it can do in the future. But I mentioned Copilot earlier, and I think data classification and Copilot, you know, are hand in hand. It's recommended. There's a lot of blog posts about it. There's a lot of videos about it. But if you're going to roll something like that out to your organization and your users, you want to make sure that stuff's properly accounted for and classified, so users aren't accessing things they shouldn't access to, and you're not seeing your data leak outside of your organization. The tool we're using for classification uses, you know, what the company considers AI or machine learning or whatever you want to call it. But a lot of security tools have had AI built into them for a number of years. And whether that's classifying data or it's, scanning through policies, it's finding vulnerabilities, it's, you know, alerting on stuff. There's AI in a lot of those products out there. We recently rolled out an enterprise browser to the organization that we kind of require certain critical applications to be accessed through. And that tool, that browser itself, has its own sandboxed AI within it. So you can go into it and you can, you know, do similar things to ChatGPT or whatever. And it's sort of contained within our organization. I do have a handful of users who we've rolled out ChatGPT teams like licenses to, enterprise licenses to, where they're not training models on our organizational data, but users who are using it for helping with grants or writing policy or contract review. There are a handful of members on our board that are very interested in AI use cases. So I'm actually pulling stuff together. Again, some of my meetings with these departments, I have a small little committee together, work group together, and we're building out use cases that these departments are using that might gain us some efficiencies using generative AI. I want to be specific when I say AI. In this case, we're talking about generative AI. And how we can gain efficiencies, make some people's jobs easier, maybe alleviate some of that pressure where we haven't been able to find a candidate for a role, or not just in the IT or security space, but kind of across the board. So we're building all those out and doing a lot of different tests and stuff. I'll note one interesting one because we're on a podcast. I learned about this one just last week, but there's a place you can go and you can give it a link to a web page or a YouTube video or any number of sources that you want to feed to it, and it will generate a podcast of people talking about it. And it's like a couple of AI automated voices coming on, and they're just having a discussion about all the data you've given them. And I just thought it was amazing. It sounded fantastic. And some of the use cases people said were, well, I've been putting terms and conditions pages in for software or contracts, and then it turns it into a podcast, and two people are just talking back and forth about everything that's in the terms and conditions page. And I was like, that's
yeah, that's our, we were out in Phoenix, and our keynote speaker, it was the day before, he was from the CISO from Circle K, and he was, he was like, hey, whoever he was talking to, can you do my opening introduction in a spooky way? And it was kind of fun because it was the day before Halloween. And so she took what his topic was going to be, the AI tool, and just opened up his presentation. And that voice in a spooky way, it was kind of fun. Yeah. It was interesting also in Phoenix. I didn't really realize what I was seeing until I left. When I was out getting my Uber, they have all tons of them. And I was like, what are those cars? And I didn't figure it out until a few weeks later. I was like, oh, those were AI Ubers, you know, but I don't see those pop up on my Uber app. You know, do you want to?
Yeah.
I don't know what it's, I wonder how those people got that ride.
I was in Scottsdale earlier in the year, and whether Wemos or something like that is what they're called. But yeah, the self-driving cars with nobody in it.
Yeah.
And, it up. And some people had really good experience with them, and they're everywhere out there. They're huge out in that area. One guy I know got into some weird loop in the hotel parking lot, and the Wemo couldn't get out. It just drove him in circles. like in 10 minutes, someone finally called him from, I guess, Wemo headquarters and was like, are you having trouble? He's like, yeah, we've been driving in circles and it won't leave the parking lot. And they had to like
Oh my God. That'd be a little, I guess it must have its own app. They must be, because I travel all over and they must be test piloting that out in Phoenix. And I wish I had known, because I was on the way to our event and I would have loved to talk to the locals about what they're doing there. But that is probably one of the only airports I've seen so many of them at. So I don't know. Somebody said, Jewel Clark said, Waymo, they have their own app. Huh. Interesting. I'll have to check it out. I don't know if I'm ready to get in a car without a driver. So what's your thought on that?
It's a common, I think.
Yeah. You know, when I'm in the airport, you know, there's so much now that the, you know, automated machines and that's been around for a while, but it's becoming more and more, I like having a real person wait on me when I just want to go get a water or something, you know, and I feel bad for those people. Are they going to start losing their jobs? You know, I mean, what you said that there might be some positions that you guys could turn into from AI. What can you give us some examples of what kind of positions that a real person had that you can turn it over to machine learning?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the best examples I've heard someone say about AI is like, it's a very excited intern from an Ivy League university. It's really, really smart. It really, really, really wants to help, but you have to put up some guardrails around it to kind of get it to where you want to go. So, so you have that piece. So you have this really excited intern that's super pumped to help you out. And then you have, I think a lot of those entry level and some administrative level type jobs would super really benefit from either an AI or eventually will probably be able to be replaced by an AI. I'm not talking about getting rid of any of my people for AI yet, but I definitely want to supplement them with AI, generative AI in the interim. And then, you know, we have a couple roles like some in the business office, we have some admin assistants and stuff that we haven't been able to fill, and other people are picking up the load for that role because we've spread out the work. And I think giving them an AI tool assistant would immensely help in some of their roles, whether that's crafting emails and scheduling meetings and just figuring out how stuff sort of works on their own. Like I helped one lady earlier in the week and she was trying to do this very elaborate Microsoft bookings sort of setup for students during finals to get massages and relax, you know, students got it made with massages and stuff. But, and she was like struggling to figure it out. And I was like, have you asked generative AI? Have you asked ChatGPT? And, you know, she was able to put in her question, ask specifically what she wanted to do. And it spit out the exact details on what she needed to do. And you know, I want to give that tool to the help desk so they can help people faster. But if my end users have some tools like that, then they might not need to call the help desk, which is great. They can kind of help themselves. And I think people also like being able to do that in some instances. So, again, on these places we haven't been able to fill the role, like, yeah, let's give an admin assistant Gen AI to help her, you know, schedule meetings and coordinate calendars and write this and that and do all the other stuff. And that can, you know, lessen the load that she's had on her to make up for these empty positions, which I think will be great. I think that there's a double-edged sword there a little bit too, where you have, again, so Gen AI is kind of like your excited intern, and you're giving that to people who maybe haven't ever managed someone before or don't have any management skill. And I think there's definitely a learning curve there where it's not, you know, Gen AI is not a person, but if you're not good at managing other people, you might struggle managing Gen AI, that excited intern, because you kind of need to be specific with it. You got to tell it what you want to do, and then you have to follow through sometimes. You got to check some of the work. So it's almost like managing a person. So those people kind of will have to learn a little bit about how to manage that tool, that intern. And also you have people who are sometimes slow to adapt to technology. So there's definitely some learning that has to happen there. You need to have good training resources. You need to kind of explain how the tool works and what they need to watch out for and do, but, definitely some good use cases out there and some productivity hacks and support, I think, that are very beneficial.
Well, and I think you just need the right team to, you know, be able to implement some of those, you know, like we're a small team, but everyone on my team that does their job, they do it so great that you know, they don't want someone to help them because they don't want someone to mess up what they do. So I think that's where, you know, some of this Gen AI will help our team, because, you know, we're like going through some processes to figure out how to, you know, how to not do things so antiquated. So I think that's where there's some AI tools out there. But again, you know, how is a corporation supposed to find those tools? You know, it's going to be the people like Zach Lewis that help, you know, the teams find them. So what would your advice be for, you know, a mid-sized company to, who would they go to help find some of these different processes, these new AI tools that can help their employees make their jobs simpler to help them be more productive in other areas of their job?
Right. I mean, the best, you know, if you're an individual contributor and you want to learn how to help, I mean, YouTube is your friend, right? You can find everything under the sun there. And I have probably 15 or 20 videos queued in my watch later around different tools or examples of use cases or things you can do with the various different Gen AI platforms. I actually this week just wrapped up a course I was taking on competing in the age of AI at a separate university that I've been in for 8 weeks. And that just talked about how you go about building these systems, how these systems learn and structure and going into the security around them, the ethics, the bias, the, you know, anything that kind of pertains to AI and how people use it. We jumped into some use cases. We tested different things and, you know, that was really eye-opening. So there are obviously a lot of classes out there that are getting spun up. I think locally here in St. Louis, the University of Missouri, St. Louis, they offered a workshop the other day, a free workshop people could come to around Gen AI use cases. And I participated in that and it was pretty good. So, I mean, there's definitely resources out there. There's a handful of good books. Co-Intelligence by Ethan Mullock was a fantastic read. I read that one earlier in the year. That's a good place to get your feet wet. And, you know, follow those people on LinkedIn, see if they have YouTube videos. Like I said, lots of YouTube videos on that stuff. We also are, being a higher ed campus, we have lots of learning resources. So we all subscribe to LinkedIn Learning at the university, and there's dozens of ChatGPT guides in there and Copilot guides in there. So we actually started assigning some of those, some of our users, so they can watch them and get a little video training. And then once they feel confident, we've been kicking a license over as we've been getting into a good spot with our data classification for some of those users.
Yeah, YouTube is the jack of all trades. I'm telling you, just anything now. What did we do before YouTube? You know, it's like, who needs to read the directions that come in a box anymore? You just YouTube it and put it together. You know,
that's the thing with this technology. I mean, like before YouTube, yeah, how did you learn how to, you know, wire an outlet or paint this or stain that or cook food? You know, you had to find somebody, you had to read it in a book, but now you can go and watch a video. And now we're seeing the next iteration of that with AI. And it's like, well, I don't even need to watch it anymore. I might be able to just ask this tool and it'll tell me. And now they have these things called AI agents and you can install them. And it'll actually, I've seen them go on a computer. They open up web pages. They build stuff. They can do whatever you tell it to on your computer. So am I going to get to the point where I don't even need to watch a video anymore? I just say, hey, AI agent, I need you to go out and plan this dinner party and buy this food on, you know, walmart.com. And I need you to have it delivered to my house and have these recipes ready for this amount of people. And it just kind of does it for you. Right. So we're seeing that next iteration, that next jump. And these jumps are coming a lot faster, a lot closer together and having a bigger impact. You mentioned the jobs, and if we'd see, you know, if I'd be able to get rid of any jobs and use Gen AI, and while I can't, I think there are industries that are getting rocked by that. I mentioned that Co-Intelligence book, and in there it talked about stock photography and how the stock photography industry is like a $6 billion industry of just, you know, photos these companies make to populate into picture frames and stores and stuff. But if you have a generative AI system now like ChatGPT, and you can say, hey, generate me a photo of a happy family for a 4x6 picture frame, and it just does. Do you need a stock photo company anymore? Or can you now just print out this generated photo and throw it in all your pictures. Like, why are you going to go and spend money when you can just do it for the low price of whatever your monthly fee is for your Gen AI tool? You just save your company a ton of money.
Yeah, that's it's good and sad, you know. I mean, there's a I don't know. I guess that's for another show. You know, it's just interesting. Everything's just so easy compared to how it used to be. You can get anything you want, you know, like just in the snap of a finger. Yesterday, I'm in Utah and I was just trying to order some food from my Uber Eats, and my Uber Eats was down for like 10 minutes. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to get my shoes on and go in the car and go drive and go get some food. You know, it's just, we've just become so it's reliant on technology. You know,
I saw a story about a guy who was on a plane, and when he landed in a, I don't know, an airport in Colorado, where it's not where he was from. And I can't remember if it was the CrowdStrike incident from earlier in the year, or if it was like an incident where like AT&T was down like across part of the country or something that was earlier in the year than that. But he landed and like everything was down. And he pulled out his phone. There's no Wi-Fi. His cell signal's down. He couldn't get Google Maps up. He couldn't get, you know, Uber up to get a car, or Lyft up to get a car. And he was in a town he didn't know. And he was writing about this online. He was like, I just was lost. You know, I didn't know how to function anymore. Everything was down technology wise. And it's a skill no one practices anymore. And it's like, well, how do I get to my hotel? I don't even know the name of my hotel or the address.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
What am I going to do?
Yeah. I don't, you know how often I travel, and I don't know the name of my hotel until I land, you know, and then I go and look and see where I'm going. I have no idea. Yeah. So we are so reliant, and it's just continuing, you know, it's going to continue to, you know, just change, evolve, and what your kids are going to grow up is, you know, you have small kids, is a whole different world than, you know, what my kids who are in their 20s now grew up in, you know. And from my youngest child who's 20 to my oldest child who's 28, there's a huge gap in what she sees from the 28-year-old, you know, like she's in a whole different era, you know, of like, TV. I don't even think they watch TV. It's all YouTube. Everything they watch is on YouTube. But you know, so it's definitely interesting times, and you see it all. You're at a university, so you know it's just everything's different. And you know, what's your thoughts before we have about 3 or 4 more minutes? What's your thoughts of social media? And, you know, a few years ago, it was, you know, so taboo, you know, you better not go on TikTok. You better not do any of this. And where do you feel, because you see it, you're around students all the time. What's your thoughts on social media like that?
Oh man. it's going to be a hot minute before any of my kids get on social media. That's for sure. I think there's definitely some negatives to it. There's some nice things about it, but I know kids who are, you know, early teens and stuff in some of the grade schools and going into high school. And the one thing they use more than anything, it's Snapchat. And they're always like, well, what's your snap? Let's share snaps or whatever. And it's, for me, that's kind of like, oh man, that's kind of scary that they're sending stuff back and forth and chats and stuff and pictures that you can't see. There's no detection of, and they're just kind of gone.
You can never get those photos back. And I didn't realize we were down to probably a minute here. So it went so fast with you. But what would your in 20 seconds, what would your word of advice be to all those students and younger people out there and everyone? What can we do today to keep us a little bit safer?
I mean, guys, be careful what you're sending out there, what you're saying. There, you know, if it hits the internet, it's going to always be there. And I think it can always be used against you later, or it'll come back to haunt you. So just be smart. Don't send anything out you wouldn't want your parents to know about, or your grandma to know about, and you should be okay.
Well, Zach Lewis, he's the AVP of IT and CISO over at the University of Health Sciences and Pharmacy of St. Louis. Thanks for being on the show again. Look forward to hopefully see you at our upcoming St. Louis event next March. Thanks so much for being here today, Zach. Everyone else, thanks for tuning in to another episode of And Security for All. I hope you all have a great weekend. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next week.
thank you for tuning into And Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hakem, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific time and 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hakem. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to futureconevents.com or email info@futureconevents.com. Or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. Don't miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series, focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hakem, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.